I still keep coming across people who've found faith through Pascal, partly because he speaks to the modern condition in a way that very few writers at that time do. So, for example, he's writing on the other side of the discovery of the telescope. He can look into the night sky and see the stars and the kind of vastness of space, and realizes how small and tiny and insignificant we are within the universe in a way that, you know, Luther and Calvin never would have thought that. So Pascal looks into space and he says, "Now the eternal silence of infinite space terrifies me."
Does doctrine really matter? The Apostle Paul once wrote to a young pastor named Titus, instructing him to hold firm to the trustworthy word he was taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine. Welcome to Credo Podcast, where doctrine matters and theological ideas have consequences. Here's your host, Dr. Matthew Barrett, executive editor of Credo Magazine.
Welcome to the Credo Podcast, where we contemplate God with the wisdom of the great tradition as we seek to model and exercise a faith-seeking understanding. I am Matthew Barrett, your host. One of my favorite centuries is the 17th century. I know that oftentimes the 16th century receives a lot of the attention, in large part because of the Reformation. However, we sometimes ignore the 17th century. But if we take a hard look at it, we discover that actually the 17th century is pivotal. It's pivotal for all kinds of reasons. For some, those may be positive reasons. For others, quite negative reasons. But either way, we have to deal with the 17th century, in which we see the rise of everything from modernity even the conversation over atheism that seems to start emerging, even if it's very early on, to a wide variety of theologians and especially philosophers who are attempting to answer some of the oldest epistemological questions of that Christianity faced. But they're doing so in ways that are new and sometimes very controversial. Well, all that to say, in our episode today, we have a special privilege because we're going to talk with an expert in many ways, not just on someone like Luther, but on Blaise Pascal, and that is, of course, Graham Tomlin. He is the editor-in-chief of Seen and Unseen. You can go find that at seenandunseen.com. He's also the president of St. Mellitus College. And previously, he was Bishop of Kensington between 2015 and 2022. You probably are familiar with him. I doubt I need to introduce him so much because you've probably read some of his books that include Luther's Gospel, Reimagining the World. Other books such as Theology and the Death of Christ and Paul, Luther, and Pascal. But of course, I want to talk about his most recent book on Blaise Pascal, and I love the subtitle here, which leaves some ambiguity and lots of questions to be asked. The Man Who Made the Modern World. And that's where we will venture in this episode. Well, let's transition, because you've also written a very significant, large, and I would say very moving book on Blaise Pascal, The Man Who Made the Modern World. I must admit, as much as I really enjoyed each chapter, the introduction grabbed me, which I know that sounds cliche because that's what the introduction is supposed to do, but oftentimes in books, they don't. Your introduction really grabbed me because it held up Pascal and warts and all, so that you could see his brilliance, his genius, as well as the tensions in his own thought and his contributions across so many disciplines. So as a theologian, I'm so eager to turn that corner into his understanding of the Christian faith. But I'm trying to resist because the man really was a polymath of sorts. I mean, in your introduction, I love what you say there, because you introduce him as someone who really is on par with a Leonardo da Vinci, a John Milton. And yet the wild thing about Pascal's life is he dies in his 30s, which is just astounding. So before we get into his apologetics or his contribution to philosophy and theology, can you just help us understand his overall contribution, including his scientific contribution with so many of his discoveries? Maybe I could even call some of them inventions. Give us a little bit of a taste for that.
Yeah, as you say, Matthew, he is an extraordinary polymath who tussles so many different areas of life. That's partly because of the period he lived in. You know, nowadays when you go to college, you have to study either modern languages or physics or mathematics or history or whatever it might be. But in those days, they kind of blurred into each other. You know, so Descartes was a mathematician and a philosopher at the same time, just like Pascal was. But Pascal, he has even greater range of interest. So he's a mathematician. You know, he does really important work early on in something called conic sections. He comes up with a thing called the mystic hexagram, Pascal's theorem, which is a very elegant bit of mathematics about the discovery of intersection of points on an ellipse and so on. He does some work on cycloids, which led to kind of integral calculus. He's most famous for his work on probability theory. And, you know, probability theory is everywhere today. You know, pretty well every invention, you want to work out the probability of an accident happening. You know, we work out, you know, on our engineering, we calculate risks all the time. Insurance is based on probability, and Pascal basically it helped to invent probability theory. So he's a really significant mathematician. He's a scientist. He's a physicist as well. He did a series of experiments on the existence of a vacuum, which at the time was really quite controversial, because philosophically a number of figures were saying that there cannot be such a thing as a vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum. There should not, you know, there cannot be such a thing as nothing. And Pascal took a very different approach, which is an experimental approach to science. And so he's different from many others of his day to think, well, you arrive at things not by asking what did Aristotle think or what is the sort of philosophical a priori theorem that dictates your result, but you do experiments. You look at the data and you work out the best explanation for them. You know, so he's a scientist, he's an entrepreneur. You know, he built one of the very first functioning calculating machines in Europe, which is often where the story of the computer is told. You know, that the Pascaline, the calculating machine that he built, is often told as part of that story. It was never a great commercial success, but technologically it was a big step forward, you know, towards the digital age that we have. So in all those sort of spheres, he's also little things like, you know, he invented buses. He was basically the person who, you know, during his lifetime, Paris doubled in size in the first half of the 17th century. He realized that was a problem for poor people. They couldn't get around. The rich were fine because they could get around in their carriages. So he had this idea of raising some money from his wealthy friends, founding a company, buying up a whole series of carriages that would go from point A to point B, stop off at various places on the way. You could get on the bus, you could get on the carriage, pay a small amount of money and get off at another point. And they were public. There is basically the first urban transportation system in Europe. Wow. And he was one of the first people to wear his timepiece on his wrist as opposed to in his pocket. So basically someone who's basically invented the watch, the computer, insurance, air pressure, and all kind of things. He had a hand in all these things. So many of the things that we take for granted, his fingerprints are all over them, which is kind of why we think of him as why the subtitle of the book is The Man Who Made the Modern World. You know, his fingerprints are pretty well all over pretty much everything we take for granted.
Hi friends, Matthew Barrett here. I'm interrupting our conversation to tell you about something quite personal to me right here in Kansas City. Did you know that I lead a school of theology called Anselm House? Anselm Fellows come together in my own home for evening prayer around a common rule of life, the Book of Common Prayer. And then we also have a meal together around a common table that cultivates virtue and the good life.
And finally, we sit down for Socratic dialogue because Anselm Fellows are reading through the great tradition. Of course, we're doing all this to contemplate the beauty of our Lord. It's named after Anselm, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who so modeled faith-seeking understanding. Did you also know that many of our Anselm Fellows agree through Trinity Anglican Seminary? In fact, you can receive up to 50% off and 50% of your entire degree through Trinity Anglican Seminary. It really is unprecedented. But best of all, did you also know that Anselm Fellows, they're not just coming and meeting in my home. They're also participating in the liturgy of the church here at St. Aidan's Anglican Church. In other words, their education is fully integrated with the sacramental theology and life of the church. It really is wonderful. I can tell you this from experience. It's one of a kind. Why don't you come to Kansas City? Join us. Become an Anselm Fellow. Go to theanselmhouse.com, theanselmhouse.com. There you will find an application. Send it in. We'd love to consider it. And we'd love to see you here in Kansas City as an Anselm Fellow.
It's remarkable. I mean, I really can't imagine of one individual in which all of this is coming out of the same person. It gives us a bit of an understanding for the technological turn that takes place. I think sometimes we think, oh, that's just the 20th century or the 21st century, and we fail to give credit to someone like him, where he is, it's not just one, but it is a variety of discoveries, some of which are controversial. Now, speaking of controversial, the 17th century to put it positively, it is an adventure. To put it negatively, it can feel like chaos at times, depending on how you're looking at it. Just to take one example, so you have on the one hand the Jansenists and in the Catholic Church, and at the same time you have certain philosophical thinkers within the Church. I think this is hard for us to imagine today, within the Church, who are considering, entertaining. It's hard to know to what extent there's some debate there historically. Atheism. And this is important to talk about because this has a lot to do how certain Christian philosophers and theologians will respond to that atheism is telling, and it's going to set them apart from someone like Pascal. What is happening in the 17th century France that atheism would suddenly be talked over some coffee, I suppose.
Yeah, you've got a huge amount of social change going on in Europe at the time. Because in France, you have to recognize there is this rebellion called the Fronde, which is kind of social rebellion against King Louis XIII and Louis XIV.
Mm-hmm.
It only goes so far. It doesn't really kind of achieve very much because, of course, here in England, we had the Civil War. We had our own Civil War where we killed the king. And we had a republic for 10 years. It didn't work out very well. And we got the king back again in 1660 and so on. So it's a really tumultuous period. And so in some ways, because of that tumultuous period, everything is slightly up for grabs, certainly here in England. You've got all these kind of Protestant sects kind of spinning off in different directions, the Quakers and the Shakers and the levelers and the diggers and all these sort of things. So you've got almost every idea is spinning around in this period of great social and intellectual turmoil. I think the other part of it is that in the 17th century, you've got, the 30 Years' War that happens from 1618 to 1648, which was the kind of great, and there's lots to it, obviously, but part of it was a kind of great confrontation between, how is the Reformation going to play out? Is Europe going to become Protestant or Catholic? Or basically what emerges out of that is a kind of uneasy truce between them. That inevitably raises the question, who's right? Are the Catholics right? Are the Protestants right? Or are neither of them right? And so, if you like, in this ferment of ideas, it's not surprising that some people begin to experiment with the possibility of atheism. Now, again, as you say, it's disputed how many atheists there were. There probably weren't that many real atheists. It's more something that begins in the 18th century, I think. But you can see the seeds of it, and Pascal is aware of it as a possibility. And so he does write about atheism as a potential thing. Now, you can say that some of the figures around the time were kind of, atheism was a bit of a bogeyman. It was something that, you know, there weren't very many real atheists, but because it was beginning to be talked about, there was a kind of fear of it. And so Pascal actually does engage with it in a way, in a much more creative way, I think, than most of his other contemporaries do at the time. And so I think those are some of the reasons why atheism begins to be thought of, because it's such a time of rapid, you know, social change, intellectual discovery. You're beginning the beginnings of the scientific method and reason. Someone like Descartes, for example, is the great proponent of a kind of rationalist approach to knowing things. And he, if you like, if in that move that he makes to sort of make the thinking self the center of everything and rebuild the world from this core philosophical principle, I think, therefore I am, you could argue that God has been slightly shifted from the center of the picture at that moment. That humanity is becoming the center. And then God becomes a sort of a logical step to be made from that position. So you can see how God has begun to be shifted out of the center of the picture, and the self, the thinking self, has become the center of the picture. Maybe that's part of it as well. And again, Pascal, I think, sees where this is going in a way that very few other thinkers of his day do, which is why I think the project that the Pensée was about is so compelling and still speaks to our age today, because he anticipates a lot of where we've got to today in the origins of those thinking at that time.
I'm really glad you mentioned Descartes, because this is crucial to understanding him. That is Pascal in contrast. I don't remember if these were your words or Pascal's words, but there's this one point where one of you, both of you, mentioned that with Descartes, God so subtly becomes more like the furniture in the room, or a piece of furniture in the room, rather than the object of our gaze, our knowledge, our love and delight. I thought that was a really fitting picture for the shift that takes place there as well. Now, you mentioned Descartes, but there's others as well, right? That are throwing this age into throwing all kinds of questions out there. Someone like Michel de Montaigne, who's a bit earlier, but nonetheless challenges that thinking of Descartes that will evolve in certain ways. There's certain points of his philosophy, for example, where he says, well, Descartes wanted a certain type of certainty. We could say, well, in this case, the only certainty to be found is the certainty that you cannot be certain. And perhaps there's a foreshadowing there of postmodernism, though that might be a little bit anachronistic, but it's there. There's still the focus on the self, though, in which he makes this bold claim that he is his metaphysic. And you can start to sense some of the erosion there of the great thinkers of the great tradition and the importance of metaphysics for reality. And then even a turn, not so much to reason, but still at the same time, oddly enough, making room for authority. It seems that the Catholic Church is the one thing that he made exception for. How is he so different than Pascal?
Yeah, well, Montaigne is a very interesting figure for Pascal. He's obviously from the century beforehand. You know, Descartes and Pascal were contemporaries. They actually met on one occasion, twice over a weekend. You'd love to be a fly on the wall of that conversation, wouldn't you? but in many ways, Montaigne is the figure that Pascal is even more intrigued by than Descartes. He actually thinks Descartes in some ways is relatively easy to counter, but Montaigne, I think he's more troubled by it in some ways. So Montaigne is the great skeptic.
Yeah.
And that may be part of the story of atheism that we were talking about a moment ago, because Montaigne is, you could describe Montaigne as a kind of functional atheist in the sense that he believes in God because the Catholic Church says so.
Yeah.
But God doesn't really play a very big part in his philosophy and his musings, his book. He says, you know, my book is about myself. His essays, which is a great set of writings that he does, is basically a kind of meditation on his own motivation, his own thinking, his own self.
Yeah.
He's fascinated with his own inner workings and how, you know, how that plays out. And so you've got on the one side of Pascal, you've got Montaigne, the great skeptical tradition that says, I mean, Montaigne's great statement, great sort of phrase was, que sais-je? What do I know? Not even, I don't know anything, is what do I know?
Yeah.
You know, I can't be certain of very much at all. Much of what we take for granted is just custom. It's just things that we've invented, the way we do things around here. And so in some ways he is the kind of precursor of the great postmodern trend of our time, you know, where everything is up for grabs, nothing is certain. There is no ultimate truth out there to be found. Or if there is, it's beyond us.
Yeah.
And so there's definitely a strand from Montaigne through to that tradition. Then on the other hand, he's got Descartes, who is, if you like, the precursor of the great rationalist sort of scientific method of our day. You think of someone like a Richard Dawkins in our time, who is very confident that science can tell you everything you need to know about the world. And Pascal plays these two over against each other, skeptical tradition and the rationalist tradition. And there's one particular conversation he has soon after his great night of fire, his great sort of experience of God, which in some ways was a key moment for him, where he talks with one of his Jansenist friends in the monastery that they are part of. And he puts these two alongside each other. He's, on the one hand, you've got the skeptical tradition, Montaigne. On the other side, you've got the rationalist tradition of the Epictetus. He talks about the Stoic and then Descartes. And he says, well, the thing is that these two traditions, they cancel each other out.
Yeah.
But the reality is you can't be a total rationalist because reason has its limits. There are certain things that reason cannot do. He says, you know, that imagination is more powerful than your reason. You know, our logic is not as strong as our longings. Our desires are stronger than our reason. That actually we tend to believe what we want to believe. It's that Augustinian perspective, you know, our hearts so often rule our heads. But on the other side, he says, you can't be a total skeptic either.
Yeah.
In our terms, you know, even the most skeptical postmodern philosopher puts the kettle on and expects it to boil. There are things that are just the way things are. They're given to us. And so Pascal says, well, how do you, if these two traditions of thought cancel each other out, how do you make sense of them? And he says, well, one talks about the weakness, the frailty of humanity, the fact we can't really understand anything. We are just left on our own. The other is all about the greatness of humanity, our capacity to understand everything. How do you put together kind of humanity's weakness and greatness, other than the idea that we are both created in the image of God with this capacity to understand the world, with this ability to love and to create beauty and so on. And yet, on the other hand, we are fallen. Our desires overrule our heads. We are kind of morally compromised in all kind of ways. And so he presents kind of Orthodox Augustinian Christianity as the kind of way of making sense of both of these kind of philosophical traditions. And that, I think, it's a clever move. It's a quite a genius little move. Now, you could develop it a lot more, but it's kind of what Pascal does.
You mentioned a minute ago that night of fire, as it sometimes is called. And there's a story here, isn't there? Because, you know, as he's turning away from those two, and the skepticism in particular that you mentioned, he's in some ways he is very sober in the way he acknowledges it. But then he turns, and this night of fire is really crucial to understanding, well, what is he turning to exactly as an alternative? Now, what I so enjoyed when you were telling the story is there's so much more to the story than most have heard. His sister, for example, as well as the Jansenists,
Can you help us understand what is building up to this point, this night of fire? How does he get there? And how is his sister and the Jansenists, how are they all a bit of a backdrop to it?
Yeah, well, Pascal's family background is he was brought up in a fairly conventional Catholic family. His mother died when he was 3 years old, so he doesn't really remember her much. But he has two sisters, an older sister, Gilberte, and a younger sister, Jacqueline. During Pascal's teenage years, his father has an accident and they bring in bone setters. That's kind of what you did in those days to sort of set the bone. And these bone setters weren't ordinary bone setters. They were Jansenist bone setters. In other words, they used their medical prowess to kind of get into homes and convert people to Jansenism. Yeah. Now, Jansenism, for those who don't know, was a particular strand of 17th century Catholicism. It was quite austere, quite stark in its devotion, very focused upon the teaching, on particular interpretation of the teaching of St. Augustine, very strong on grace, very strong on sin, very strong on kind of, sacramental focus.
This is an odd way to evangelize.
It was a little bit odd way to evangelize. It takes odd things sometimes. Anyway, they managed to kind of draw the family towards Jansenism. And Pascal's younger sister, Jacqueline, is very taken with this. She reads all the Jansenist works of devotion, and she ends up joining the convent, which is associated with Jansenism in Paris. Blaise himself is sort of partly drawn to it, but at the same, so he's drawn to this spiritual movement, which emphasizes, prayer and devotion and turning your back on the world. But at the same time, he's also embarking on his scientific kind of work. And he becomes famous as a scientist, as a mathematician. He's in demand at all the salons in Paris. They all want to hear him talk and so on. So he's really struggling, I think, with this sense of being, this famous scientist, mathematician is the sort of talk of the town in one sense. And on the other hand, this call to the life of devotion, the life of seclusion, turning your back on the world. That's very much the Jansenist way, was you must turn your back on all these frivolous things, like being famous and science and mathematics and all that kind of thing. They did have a philosophical arm to them, but there was a kind of strict, spiritual a decision that needed to be taken to turn away from the world. This is what Pascal is struggling with. And he has a bit of a falling out with his sister at one point, and that complicates matters a little bit, which all leads up to this event on, and we know the date. It's November the 23rd, 1654, when Pascal is in his room alone at night, when he has this profound encounter with God, where for 2 hours, and we know it's from 10:30 in the evening to 12:30 midnight, he has this deep, deep encounter with God. We only know about it because he wrote a poem about it, put it in his, he sewed it inside his jacket. It was only found after he died. He never told anybody about this experience. But looking back, people can make sense of it. And what he discovers on that night, I think, is, people listening to the podcast may have heard of the phrase, the God of the philosophers. Well, this is where that phrase comes from, because in this account of this experience, which is called the Memorial, it's just kind of one page. It's quite short, and Pascal reads it. He says, "The God of Jesus Christ, not the God of the philosophers." So it's almost a deliberate turning away from the God of Descartes, the God who is the product of a series of intellectual, philosophical, a priori arguments, a God that you can reach through philosophical syllogisms. That's not the kind of God he's encountering here. This is what he calls the God of Jesus Christ, the God who basically approaches him on a kind of personal level, on a sense that, there's a quote that Pascal says in the Pensée, which I think captures this really well. He says, the God of the Christians is a God of love and consolation. He's a God who fills the heart and soul of those whom he possesses. He's a God who makes them inwardly aware of their wretchedness and his infinite mercy, who unites himself with them in the depths of their soul, who fills it with humility, with joy, with confidence and love, who makes them incapable of having any other end but him. That's the kind of God he's discovered, who is the God of Jesus Christ, a deeply personal God, not this abstract God that Descartes is talking about. And that, I think, is foundational for Pascal. And from that moment onwards, he doesn't give up entirely on his scientific work. but they very much take their place as a sort of secondary thing for him. And his focus from that point on was on two things, really. One is the poor. He becomes devoted to engaging with and entering into the experience of poverty, because he felt that's who Christ spent his time with. But also with this project to try and convert his skeptical, sophisticated, scientific, you know, or just rather kind of, you know, friends around Paris who found God rather boring. And he wanted to help them to realize that their true happiness could only be found in God himself. Mm. And that's what became the Pensée, which is this great apology for the Christian faith that he never finishes, but was published as the Pensée. So that's really the kind of bit of the story. Yeah.
So talk to us about the Pensée, because in many ways, there's all kinds of struggles, especially after his death, as to how to put these together. And there's even disagreement. What do you think Pascal meant these to be? And what's he after? Because you know, if a college student picks it up and they just start reading it, they might feel like, this is random. And are these just someone's secret random thoughts of just, you know, what their mind's going through at any particular moment of any day? Or is there a method to the madness? What is he doing here? And maybe you could touch on specifically this. It comes out in some of them, right? This idea that God hides.
Yeah, that's a really central idea to the Pensée. So the story really is that after this night of fire, he conceives of this idea that he wants to write something that would convince his sophisticated skeptical friends. They're not atheists. They're kind of, you know, they're traditional Catholics, but they don't really take God very seriously.
Mm.
He wants to kind of convince them that their true happiness will be found in God. And so he starts to kind of write down ideas that come to him. And his method is he will write them on a scrap of paper. Some of them are just a line. Some of them are a paragraph. Some of them are like long essays. And he begins to collect them together. And one day he would have put them together into some book, presumably. But of course, he dies at age 39 before he's able to finish this thing. So when he dies, his friends find these papers in his room and they think, well, what are we going to do with these things? We can't just throw them away. So they publish them as the Pensée, the thoughts of Monsieur Pascal on religion and various other subjects. And that's what you pick up today. So when you pick up, it's a very fragmentary text. Some bits of it you read, you have no idea what it's about. Other bits are much clearer. But it's a very kind of haunting, very powerful work. And I can still keep coming across people who've found faith through Pascal. Partly because he speaks to the modern condition in a way that very few writers at that time do. So, for example, he's writing on the other side of the discovery of the telescope. He can look into the night sky and see the stars and the kind of vastness of space, and realizes how small and tiny and insignificant we are within the universe in a way that, you know, Luther and Calvin never would have thought that.
Mm.
So Pascal looks into space and he says, the eternal silence of infinite space terrifies me.
Mm.
Now that's not a thought I think that would have occurred to Luther or Calvin or Aquinas, because they would have thought, you know, well, infinite space, that's just, you know, we're the center of it. It's what God has given us. You know, we're at the heart of it, all of this. Pascal doesn't think we're at the heart of it. He realizes we are a small, tiny part. So he speaks to that sense, that modern sense of, are we alone in the world? Are we just some tiny, insignificant bit of life on some little bit of rock that is spinning around another bit of rock that is spinning around another galaxy elsewhere and so on? And yet, at the same time, we do feel ourselves to be significant. We do have this extraordinary capacity to understand the world. How do you make sense of this thing called humanity? He talks of us, you know, as we are the glory and the refuse of the universe. That's his definition of humanity. We're the glory and the refuse of the universe. And then he thinks about God. And this is one of the interesting things about him, that, you know, a lot of the apologists at the time were saying, well, you know, we can prove God by reason, the Descartes approach. And we can give you all kinds of reasons why God exists. And Pascal's not really convinced by that, partly because he thinks that our reason is not as straightforward as we think it is. It's influenced by our longings and our desires, but also because he thinks that kind of certainty is not possible to us in our current state. And so he says very plainly, look, there isn't a lot of evidence for God out there. God doesn't speak at you. You don't see him when you go to go around, when you walk down the street. And actually, all the kind of apologetic arguments, they don't really convince the person who doesn't really want to believe. And so the other possibility is atheism. Well, in that case, if you can't see God, if you can't kind of, you know, if he doesn't appear to be apparent within the world, if science doesn't get you to God, maybe there isn't such a thing as God. And Blaise Pascal comes up with a third possibility and says, well, maybe the answer is not the obvious God or the absent God, but the hidden God. In other words, that there is a God, but he is hidden from us, and he deliberately hides himself from us. And he hides himself from us precisely so that we don't have the kind of relationship with God that Descartes thought he could have, which is just ticking off God as something you believe in the corner. No, it's got to be an all-consuming relationship with God, if you like. And so, but the other thing about the hidden God idea is that I think, which is again is a really clever move from Pascal. He says, well, if there is a God, he must be a hidden God because he doesn't show himself to us in a very obvious way. And then he says, well, if there is a hidden God, what religion speaks of a hidden God? And he says, well, actually, if you look at it, Christianity speaks of a hidden God because at the very place where we think, but Christians say that God is revealed to us in the person of Jesus Christ. Even there, God is hidden. In other words, you could meet Jesus, you could shake his hand, you could talk to him, and you could entirely miss the fact that you were talking to God. Mm. Because even within the flesh of Jesus Christ, God is hidden. And he goes on to that, you know, even when he's a good Catholic, saying, you know, within the bread and the wine of the Mass, you know, Christ's presence is hidden there. It's still, you know, it's never apparent, it's never obvious, it's never on the surface. Mm. And so it's a really intriguing way of thinking about God, about encouraging people to kind of think, well, maybe kind of, you know, hardline apologetics, you can prove God by reason. That's not the only option. Atheism is not the only option. The option is this idea of the hidden God, which is at the heart of his approach to the Pensée. Now, there's a lot more to the Pensée than that. You just got to read it, but yeah. I think that gives you a flavor.
This is his famous wager factor into this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the wager is an argument he uses at one particular point in the argument where I think it would have come in the point is in the course of a conversation, and he's talking to someone who is sort of poised between faith and unbelief, who thinks, well, there are some good reasons to believe, but I'm not entirely convinced. There are reasons that push me in the direction of unbelief. What do I do? And people think that the wager is a kind of a bit of clever mathematical reasoning to kind of somehow prove your way into God. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it is that at all. As the book tries to explain, his whole chapter on the wager. The wager actually is a different kind of argument from that. And basically what I think it is, it's trying to uncover the real reasons for unbelief. Mm-hmm. In other words, he basically says to this guy, like, let's do the probability. If there isn't, you know, if there's some evidence on one side, some evidence on the other, let's do the probability. And he basically says, look, if you believe God doesn't exist, and you're right, well, okay, you haven't gained a great deal, a bit of pleasure in this life, then you disappear into nothing. But if you bet that God doesn't exist and you're wrong, and you find out you're wrong, you stand to lose quite a bit. Whereas on the other side, if you bet that God does exist and you're wrong, well, again, you haven't lost a great deal, bit of sacrifice in this life. But if you're right, you stand to gain a huge amount, you know, eternal bliss in heaven. So in other words, if you were being entirely logical about it, if you were being entirely rational, you'd always bet on belief because the odds are much better that way. It's a much better bet. And now people think that's where the argument stops, but it doesn't. Because when the argument goes on, the guy then comes back to Pascal and says, yeah, okay, I can see that, but I can't make myself believe something I don't believe. Pascal says, yeah, I get that. But then he says, this is the key point. At least get it into your head. The reason you don't believe is not because of your reason, it's because of your passions. In other words, the real thing that underlies unbelief is not reason. It's not a rational thing. It's something much deeper than that. It's the heart, which is this sort of deeper moral instinct that Pascal thinks is the way we make our real decisions. So he's trying to help some people realize the real kind of grounds of the decisions they make about God. They're not, at the end of the day, rational. There's something different from that. And then he says, well, what do I do from there? And that's where Pascal says, well, act as if you did believe. Go through your life acting as if you did, but even before you do believe. And then as you do that, you will find that it begins to make sense to you. That's kind of really how the wage, I think, works, I think.
Graham, I want to make sure I give you the last word as we bring things to a close. I mean, I would say to listeners, you definitely need to pick up Graham's book. It's such a fascinating window into the 17th century, but specifically into one of the significant scientists and philosophers pushing back in some ways, as we've mentioned, against some of those who are challenging Christianity. But then in other ways, still controversial. Graham, you say at the beginning of your book, as he's pushing back against someone like Descartes and that rationalism, at the same time, there's a sense in which he's one of the makers of the postmodern world. I suppose that raises the question, for all of the good to be found in someone like Pascal, are there areas or are there instincts or whatnot where you would be a bit hesitant or shy or ways that you think even Pascal himself may need some critique here?
Yeah, and there's certain characteristics that he has. He has a rather unpleasant tendency to pummel his opponents into submission. You wouldn't want to get into an argument with Pascal.
Yeah.
He would not only defeat you, he would humiliate you. And that was not a very attractive, trend that he has. And I think it's one of the interesting things that towards the end of his life, he begins to recognize that and counter it and to recognize that this is part of his insight that reason has its limits, that you can't do that at the end of the day. So it's both a kind of philosophical point. It's also a personal point as well, that kind of very aggressive rationalist approach to finding truth and finding God, it doesn't really work on either this philosophical level or a personal level at the same time. I think, some of his teachings on grace, I think you may want to sort of, query some of those and some of the way he goes with his sort of Jansenism. And I think there are many positions where there's a little bit of confusion in his minds. As I say, that's part of the fact that he died 39 years old. He didn't have the time to work out some of the kind of the complexities and inner contradictions of some of his thoughts. So we've got to give him a bit of grace on that. There are certainly some things that I think you'd want to question about Pascal. But I think at the end of the day, I actually think the Pensée is a book about happiness. It's basically how do you become happy? And there's a sense that there's a sort of tragic sense in that of Pascal. He actually doesn't think that total happiness is available to us this side of the new creation. There is an inevitable sadness in the human condition, and that all our philosophies and our political systems are attempts to try to explain away or do away with that sadness, but we can't, because it's part of who we are as fallen people. But he does think, and that's why, his whole, what are great themes of distraction, of how he feels there is an inner emptiness. There's an inner kind of anxiety. There's a fear. There is an inner emptiness inside all of us, but we're very good at hiding it. We hide it by distracting ourselves all the time. And we are the most distracted age of them all, even more so than Pascal's age was. But he actually wants people to kind of get in touch with that inner emptiness. And so he says, try an experiment. Try sitting in your room alone for an hour with no distractions, no phone, no books, no conversation, no podcasts, nothing. And you will reach out for something to distract you because you become aware of your own inner emptiness. But it's only when you realize that you realize there is this infinite abyss within you, which can only be satisfied with something equally infinite, which is God himself. So I think he takes us on a journey, takes his reader on a journey to kind of discover who we are and what is really going on under the surface with us in order to prepare us for an encounter with the God who alone can bring us joy and the kind of happiness for which we were made.
Now you can fill up on theology each day by visiting credomag.com. There you will find the latest issues of Credo Magazine with articles on key doctrines of the faith and regular video interviews with Dr. Matthew Barrett, where he answers some of the toughest theological questions of our day. Be sure to subscribe to Credo Podcasts to join the conversation, a conversation where doctrine matters.